Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
WNYC.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. I wish I could say that we were smart enough to have planned this, but a neat thematic connection running through our program just kind of fell in our lap. That theme is the duo. You know the saying, good things come in threes? Well, some great things come in twos. Like in the early 60s, when the husband and wife team of Felice and Boudlow Bryant wrote a string of hits, actually for another duo, the Everly Brothers.
Bye bye, love. Bye bye, happiness. Hello, loneliness. I think I'm gonna cry.
Then there's the upstate New York duo of Aaron Dyer and Aaron Sanchez, who invent their own instruments and perform under the name Buke and Gase. And to begin our show today, one of rock's most enduring duos, Debra Harry and Chris Stein, who founded the band Blondie. Debbie Harry's vocals and Chris Stein's guitar playing led Blondie to a series of hits like this one, Heart of Glass. But the list also includes Rapture, Call Me, One Way or Another, and Tide is High. Blondie split up in 1982, but Debbie and Chris remained a couple till 89, and even after that, they've continued to work together in the reformed Blondie. In fact, they're going to give us a bit of an exclusive, an early taste of a forthcoming Blondie song in just a bit. But before we look ahead, let's look back. Debbie Harry, Chris Stein, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John.
It's very nice to be here.
Nice to be here.
Debbie, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of 70s stuff in the air. A lot of people writing books, remembering those days. All of a sudden, it seems. What do you think's going on right now? Why is this suddenly hitting like a critical mass?
People are getting on, you know. Their age is catching up with them, and they realize that if they don't do it now, that never get done.
I think the 60s were squeezed dry like a sponge, too, you know. I mean, there was nothing left to examine there anymore.
So the 60s was just a shriveled husk of a decade.
Well, no, I mean, yeah, but I mean, all through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, people were focused on the 60s as the mother lode of something. And now it's become the 70s that everyone is fascinated in. It's like it's eclipsed the 60s.
Well, and when you think of what came out of just New York in the 70s, punk, disco, hip-hop, all coming out of one place at one time, it was a pretty amazing time.
But it's like the Love and Spoonful never existed.
Why?
Because they were from the 60s.
All right, so assuming there is still some juice to be wrung out of the 70s.
Yeah, I think there's plenty.
Why is it all being squeezed out now, Chris?
I think certainly in New York City, being the glossy media money capital of the universe now, everybody looks back fondly on the days of when it was decrepit and rotten here. And I think there's a lot of romanticism in that decay, especially for all the young hipsters who wish they were back there in the broken buildings.
Now, do you have that kind of romantic, you know, nostalgic looking back? Do you miss those days, Debbie?
I think there was a lot of freedom. You know, we had a lot of freedom, and the pressures of they came sort of towards the end of the 70s, where people became, you know, really competitive over money. And I think there was a brief period there, you know, a 4 or 5 year period where it was all about just doing it and getting, you know, creating a good feeling for it and having the scene going on. And then little by little, you know, potential managers and small labels started checking out what was going on. And, you know, brought the scene to a new phase.
Right. And at some point it did become a scene. But when you guys first were when you first met, how much was How much activity was there downtown?
Well, the Dolls and the Velvets had been going, and, you know,
Andy Warhol.
Yeah, was firmly implanted in things, and stuff was going on. It was ongoing. I mean, there was a continuum from the 60s into the 70s, certainly.
Now, so did you guys think, well, you know, we're the next step, or you know, because we think of what happened in the mid-70s, the advent of punk, as, you know, a bunch of kids saying, no, you know, screw the past, we're breaking with that, let's tear it all down and start afresh.
It was very existential in the moment, and nobody thought about what was going on, you know, 2 minutes down the line. If we had, a lot of things would be different, you know, but everybody was pretty much there where they were.
Well, now, despite what both of you have already said about the 60s, you know, from the Ramones to Blondie to a lot of other bands of that period, you can certainly hear the roots of, you know, some of those 60s bands. And, you know, even an early song from you guys, Ripper to Shreds, for example. I mean, yeah, the language is very punk, but the musical language...
Ripper to Shreds is a complete homage to the Velvets. I mean, almost
to the Velvet Underground.
100% to Waiting for My Man. It is Waiting for My Man. And you know, the Velvets album, when they come out, 67, 68, and in the midst of all the flower power, here's this black leather heroin-based album, you know, which me and my friends were fascinated by when I was a teenager.
He's never early.
So the song Waiting for My Man from the Velvet Underground is sort of the precursor to...
Ripper to Shreds, certainly,
Ripper
yeah.
to Shreds. Although even here, you know, in Ripper to Shreds, I mean, the singing is very... This is pop singing, you know? You get to the chorus and there's, you know, the overdubbed vocals and stuff. I mean, it is not the kind of nihilist sound, perhaps, that you might have expected. This is an early song from Blondie from 1976 from the album Blondie, Ripper to Shreds.
She comes now.
A little bit of Ripper to Shreds from the album Blondie by the band Blondie. We're speaking with Debbie Harry and Chris Stein on Soundcheck today. They are part of this Platinum Punk conversation with Will Hermes, the author at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts on Wednesday, March 27th, a free conversation at 6 p.m. and here with me in the Soundcheck studio. So This first album, kind of, you know, as I said before, you know, there's that kind of pop sound to the chorus and everything. The sound of Blondie very quickly became a kind of it was open to a lot of things. It was reggae, disco in Heart of Glass, rap obviously in Rapture. How was that accepted? You know, kind of. On the scene when you guys started casting a wider net like that?
Everybody seemed to understand automatically because of me being in the band and the kind of songs that we were interested in and our sort of personal philosophies and, you know, the fact that we were part of this, you know, little social group that it would have, you know, sort of something about a girl group, something about a new, very urban New York kind of band, very poppy as well. We never really made any bones about trying to be not commercial, mm-hmm. but it seemed like a perfect excuse to try as many different styles as possible. And as I said before, it gave us a lot of freedom, and it I don't know. I guess it sort of stretched the boundaries of what things were supposed to be. You know, yeah. sort of or blurred the boundaries. You know, and then
the people I admired the most were very eclectic. You know, Bowie and the Rolling Stones, and turned over their sounds and were constantly reinventing themselves too.
Well, speaking of reinventing, you guys have, you know, some of your songs have become part of the canon, I guess, to the point that they're even jazz musicians now. Covering some of the early Blondie tunes. Let me play for you a little bit of the Bad Pluses version of Heart of Glass, and then I want to get your reaction to it. Chris Stein and Debbie Harry from Blondie with us on Soundcheck. This is the jazz trio, the Bad Plus, with a version of Heart of Glass. That is the Bad Plus.
That's pretty awesome.
It is.
Yeah, I like the Flight of the Bumblebee in the second verse.
Heart of Glass, the old Blondie song from the Bad Pluses album, These Are the Vistas. Now, you've heard that before, I'm
no,
sure.
No, I never heard that. That's
really?
Great. Yeah, no, uh-uh. My favorite version of Heart of Glass is one of the original track slowed down like 500%.
800%,
whatever it is.
Yeah. So we just had that on the show a couple
really?
Of days ago. Yeah.
I mean, that started with Justin Bieber songs being slowed down, and then recently I ran into a Heart of Glass one, and it's great. I don't know if you heard that. It sounds it's awesome. Yeah,
I heard the mashup with Philip.
Philip Glass one was nice.
Mashup.
Yeah, that's pretty great. Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Have you heard the Bad Plus version before?
No.
Oh, okay. What do you think?
I like it. I like it.
Well, now you've worked with the jazz sax player Roy Nathanson over the years quite a bit, so you have, you know, you've been a part of that scene in New York as well.
Yeah.
So now the two of you have a partnership that has lasted for decades. It was a personal partnership for a good length of that time. It is still a musical one. Is there a secret to being able to work together that long and through all the things that you guys have been through?
We have a similar mindset when it comes to a lot of things.
And at some point, Chris, you were near death. You had an illness.
I don't know for sure if I was near death, but it's a nice story anyway.
that was the story that was making the rounds. Would have been like what, mid-'80s, early 80s?
Yeah, early 80s, 82, around there.
Yeah. And Debbie, you basically took time to nurse Chris through that. This is, again, how the story goes.
Yeah, that's the story.
What was the reality?
Reality.
She was in Vegas the whole time.
Yeah.
I went on a fling.
But so, I mean, when you go through something like that, you know, to be able to come out the other end and still be able to make music together, there have been a lot of bands that have, you know, tried the comeback tour and...
Yeah, well, when we did the re-up in, 96 or something, we were determined to make new music and not go out as a, you know... oldies referencing ourselves type situation.
So in 99 you released No Exit.
Yeah.
And Debbie, was there any kind of trepidation about getting the band back together at that point?
I was not in favor of it. Chris's instinct or inspiration to do it, I guess, you know, it was meant to be, because, you know, we met the right people to help us do it. We had, as with many bands, you know, that sort of fracture, basically it's because of bad business problems and complications with labels and rights. And
this sometimes
and
the people just can't stand the sight of each other at that point. You know, we've seen that too.
Very often the reason behind that is, you know, some kind of business misunderstanding.
Forces pulling them apart, et cetera.
Well, and you know, this band coming back together did work again, because, you know, it's 1999. It's been over a decade since the back, I guess it had been about 15 years since the last Blondie record.
Yeah.
And you have a hit song. So this was a comeback that actually worked, and the hit song from the 1999 album No Exit by Blondie is this one, called Maria.
She moves like she don't care, smooth as silk, cool as air. Ooh, it makes you wanna cry. She doesn't know your name, and your heart beats like a subway train. You wanna take her?
...1999 hit from Blondie, Maria, from their comeback record, No Exit. Blondie's last album, 2011's Panic of Girls, but there is a new one on the horizon. And Debbie Harry and Chris Stein, the core of the band Blondie, are part of this platinum punk conversation with author Will Hermes, whose latest book is all about the punk scene in New York in the 70s. That'll be Wednesday, 6 p.m., March 27th, next Wednesday, at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts. It's free. Debbie and Chris are with me on Soundcheck today.
The book is really great.
Because, Will Hermes' book.
Yeah, because it goes...
It's called Love Goes to Building,
to a building on fire.
Yeah, the old talking
but it's not
title.
Just about the punk. I mean, he has a whole build-up to the punk scene going back to the late 40s and 50s. He's done a lot of really meticulous research.
The title, actually, of the Will Hermes book is Love Goes to Buildings, plural, on fire. The Talking Head song was Building on Fire. 5 years in New York that changed music forever. And it did.
Yeah.
Those periods those mid-70s years when you guys were starting and Talking Heads and television and, yes, Richard Hell and the Voidoids and all of that. And Patti Smith, another one who's written a book. So when do you guys write a book?
In the process.
Get around to it, you know. So.
Yeah.
Now, you guys are working on, as I mentioned before, a new album. Does it have a title yet?
No.
Okay. But there are a couple of things that are getting close to being ready for people to hear. And we're going to hear one of them, a song called Make a Way. Now, what's changed? Is the writing process, the recording process, is it all different now?
You know, it's a combination of a big change in the technical end of recording and the ability to, you know, do things when you're not right next to the person. It just there is really a lot more freedom.
Mm-hmm. And you talked before, Debbie, about how, you know, Blondie wanted to be able to, you know, dip into reggae and disco and rap and all that kind of stuff and pop music in general. Are you still kind of stretching things with the new material?
I have a bunch of Latin based songs on this. I last 3 years. Since just a little bit before the previous record, I've been really bugging out over modern Latin music.
Like who?
Bomba Estéreo and Sistema Solar, who are on this record, and a lot of the reggaeton guys like Wisin and Yandel and Alexis and Fido. And I particularly love all the grooves. I find it all very sexy.
Where is that Sistema Solar? Where are they from?
They're from Colombia.
Colombia, right.
They are. There's a tremendous Colombian electronica scene, which is just producing some really fabulous
stuff. So they're going to be part of the new Blondie
record?
They're
on one of the records, I was really excited about
what's
that.
What's the Mexican?
The other guys are Los Racas.
Los Racas.
From Oakland. Jeff,
nice.
They're up and coming too. Yeah.
So what can you tell me about Make a Way?
Make a Way is a really weird song that I can't classify genre wise. It started out as a Turkish groove, as a sort of Middle Eastern groove, and now almost sounds Latin in a way, and it's just an odd song. And I wrote a lot of this stuff with Jeff Salzman, our producer, which the technology helped. He was on the West Coast. He was in San Francisco, and I was in New York, and we were sending back stuff back and forth.
All right, let's hear a little bit from the forthcoming Blondie record, as yet untitled. The song's called Make a Way.
Street light shining through the window. You're playing Nintendo.
That's a little preview of what's coming next from Debbie Harry and Chris Stein and the band Blondie, a song called Make Away. And when do you think, Debbie, the record will be done?
Very soon, very soon. And I think we'll be putting it out mostly online. What we are going to do is record our shows live and have those as a package for people to get,
Kiss was doing that 20 years ago.
I know, but we are going to do that, so that wouldn't naturally include some of the new material.
Yeah.
But,
Provided we learn it.
Yeah. And then at the end of the whole thing, they'll...
You still press play and record, though.
Somewhat.
Right?
Well, you press the space bar at any rate.
All right. We've been speaking with Debbie Harry and Chris Stein. You can hear more of their conversation with author Will Hermes at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts next Wednesday, March 27th, free, 6 p.m. It's part of a program there called Platinum Punk. And Debbie Harry and Chris Stein of Blondie, guys, thank you so much for coming in and playing that clip of the new release for us.
Thank you.
This is Soundcheck. Up next, a newer duo joins us to play on the show. Buke and Gase bring their unusual instruments and their unusual sound to our studio. And later, a duo that laid the groundwork for the Nashville sound. We'll hear the story of the late songwriting team of Felice and Budlow Bryant. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and this duo, known as Buke and Gase, takes its name from the group's two primary instruments, the buke, a six-string guitar-like instrument built on a former baritone ukulele body, and the gase is a guitar-bass hybrid. The two members of the band also play various foot-operated percussion and other noisemakers, and there's obviously singing, too, so a Buke and Gase performance sees the two of them working hard, which we feel bad about since they just got off a plane from Australia and are probably exhausted. Actually, we don't feel that bad about it, so let's put them to work. Here is Buke and Gase with a song called Hiccup. Thank you. That is Buick and Gace, live on Soundcheck with a song called Hiccup. And let me introduce you to the members of the duo. Aaron Dyer, singing, playing the Buick.
Hello.
And all kinds of effects on the voice and some percussion with the foot. By contrast, Aaron Sanchez gets off relatively easy. He's playing the Gace, the guitar-bass hybrid, floor percussion, and just occasional backing vocals.
That's correct.
Nice for you. wouldn't this be easier, guys, if you actually had a percussionist and, you know, people to help so that you weren't each, like, constantly using all four limbs all the time?
Yes.
Yes and no.
The attraction of doing it yourself to this extent?
Well, we started with a drummer, and then he left, and then we were left with, figuring out what to do. And we started playing percussion with our feet just to kind of fill in or like to make it interesting because we were making a recording at the time. And then it just kind of stuck and it kind of like started to influence the music in an interesting way that we thought was unique and kind of like, you know, put us in a position that we were uncomfortable with. So I think that like presented us with a scenario where we could make music that was kind of unique and interesting.
So was it important for you guys not to feel like you were in a comfort zone when you were making music?
Not necessarily. It's just that we like the challenge of it. You know, mm-hmm. We like where it's taking us musically. Maybe it would be better with a percussionist or a drummer. We don't know. I mean, maybe we'll move in that direction in the future. I'm not sure.
But the point is it would be different.
It would be different. And it would, you know, it'd be another cook in the kitchen.
Right.
And We kind of like this way of working right now, but mm-hmm. It could change.
Well, it certainly works for us and for actually quite a few public radio listeners. Buick and Gace, you guys have been regulars at NPR Music, our colleagues down in D.C., and we've worked together on a couple of occasions here in New York, Le Poisson Rouge last fall. And girl Aaron, I mean, the Aaron and Aaron thing is... Aaron, your name, Aaron Dyer, has an E at the end, right?
Yeah.
And Aaron is just A-R-O-N. So two Aarons, and neither one of you has a double A in the name.
That's correct.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, Buick Aaron, why did you guys create the instrument? I mean, other Aaron has been talking about how, you know, the sound has been shaped by the fact that you've gone from a trio to a duo. Did you invent these instruments because you were looking for a different sound?
Aaron can probably answer that a lot better.
Well, again, it's like a musical problem that we're faced with, and like we're only two people, so how can we cover a broader sonic range? So, in my case, I started adding bass strings to a guitar. Well, I started adding guitar strings to a bass, and then now it's more of a guitar with bass strings. But so I'm able to do like a broader, you know, I can do the low end and the high end and stuff. And then Aaron's guitar sort of started as you wanted like a smaller guitar, basically.
Yeah.
So we started building off of a ukulele body, but it's not a ukulele at all.
This new one you have, Aaron, it's got a metal body. It almost looks like, you know, one of those 1920s National Steel guitars, except much, much smaller.
Yeah.
Which is handy because those instruments weigh a ton.
Yeah, well, this does weigh a ton, too.
So now, does this instrumentation affect the songwriting? Do you feel like you write? You do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. This instrument I use. It's kind of, I often double my voice, and it's kind of a way that I write melodies, mm-hmm. is by playing and singing and just kind of working it out between my voice and the guitar. So that definitely dictates. I mean, I'm sure I would do that on a guitar, a regular guitar too.
Right,
but
right.
This one's kind of more. It's become a part of me.
So. There's also, you know, as I'm sure you guys have discovered, there is a kind of thriving underground invented instrument scene. Did you guys have any connection with that before embarking on this?
Not really. I mean, I've been working as an instrument maker for a long time for, you know, Blue Man Group and different artists that need things like that. But I'm not really engaged with, like, this, you know, I'm not really, like, a geek about the mm-hmm. instrument making DIY underground thing. This is just kind of like again, to solve a problem.
It was a practical.
Yeah, it's very practical
okay.
decision.
We're speaking with Aaron Dyer and Aaron Sanchez. They are the band Buchengase. Their latest CD is called General Dome, and the first song that we heard is from it. But this next song you're going to do for us, you've released a bunch of songs in between your two LPs, and this is one of those, right?
Yeah, this is on an EP called Function Falls. It came out in September. And these recordings are actually newer than the album that just came out in January. This is an EP that we made after, it was kind of like post-recording session from mm-hmm. General Dome.
So these are, I guess that's the attraction of releasing stuff digitally, is you can get it out really
yes.
fast while you wait for the finished recording
yes.
to eventually be
and
released.
Funnily enough, we also put it out on vinyl, uh-huh. which we had to hand make in a way to get it out in time. But
God, you yeah. really are DIY all the way.
Sort of, yeah.
All right, let's hear the song. It's called Misshaping Introduction. Once again, it's the duo known as Buchengase playing live on Soundcheck. Misshaping Introduction, a song from the band Buchengase, live performance here in the Soundcheck studio. Their most recent album is called General Dome. That's from the EP that came out in the fall. Once again, Aaron Dyer and Aaron Sanchez are the two members of the band Buchengase. And Aaron, when someone says to you, oh, you're in a band, what kind of music do you play?
I get really testy and I end up kind of diverting the subject and going to something like a butterfly, and let's talk about a butterfly.
And then they turn to other Aaron and say,
I'm in the other room.
The songs, I mean, I asked you before whether the instrumentation, these invented instruments, drives the song, shapes the songwriting process. A lot of your songs do not fall into the usual verse, chorus, verse, bridge, chorus form. And that,
right.
Clearly, that's intentional.
Yes. I mean, we work a lot with improvisation. Like, we improvise for hours and record it all and then take our material out of that. So that kind of dictates the strangeness of arrangements sometimes.
All right. Now, you're just back from Australia. Was that your first tour of the
yep.
the island continent?
Yeah. Yep. First time there. It was fun.
Yeah?
Got some beach time.
Yeah. Good. It was really nice for the winter.
A little bit. But there's so much traveling there. You have to fly everywhere.
So you went to Sydney in the east and Perth in the west.
The very next day, played a show that night.
Wow.
And then
the very next day,
flew to Melbourne, which
is all
the way back.
It's basically like New York to LA and back, isn't
it? Yes, exactly.
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, you guys are great sports for coming in and playing for us in the, basically like the day after you land back here in the States. I really appreciate it. Congratulations on the new record. Thanks for playing for us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
The band is Buick and Gase. The new album is called General Dome. This is Soundcheck. You can listen to our recording sessions live as they happen. Just join us tomorrow at 2 p.m. when you'll hear the Water Boys performing a stripped-down acoustic set in our studio for an upcoming episode of the show. The Water Boys, live tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern, on soundcheck.org. Coming up, we're not done with duos yet. Hear the story of Nashville music royalty, the late great husband and wife songwriting team of Felice and Budlow Bryant. This is Soundcheck. So far on the show tonight, we've heard from a couple of duos, a duo of duos. We kicked off with Deborah Harry and Chris Stein of Blondie talking about New York in the 70s and giving us a sneak peek of an upcoming song. And a moment ago, we heard a performance by Aaron Dyer and Aaron Sanchez, who record under the name Buick and Gase. Now, the story of Country Music Hall of Famers Felice and Budlow Bryant. Even if you haven't heard of this late husband and wife songwriting team, you've probably heard their songs.
Wake up, little Susie, wake up. Wake up, little Susie, wake up.
Wake Up, Little Susie was just one of the big hits from Felice and Budlow Bryant. Franklin Bruno wrote about the Nashville duo for Oxford American back in 2011, which is when he joined us to talk about the story. And I started by asking Franklin why the Bryants aren't better known.
I don't know. I think that's a general question that you can ask about songwriters. But
we know Lieber and Stoller,
yeah.
And, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein and Rodgers and Hart. And, you know, there are songwriting
right. Well, of course, the Broadway Tin Pan Alley model is much more, you know, the shows are more important than their performers, even though they're important stars and performances. The shows keep getting revived and songs keep getting covered. But because it's just this little line under the title for most people in small print, and the songwriters tend to be the ones who aren't also performers tend to be quieter, you know, behind mm-hmm. the scenes people, the same way people don't know who the grip or the engineer is. You know, I mean, maybe the same way that people think that screenwriters write the things that the actors say.
So what about their relationship with the Everly Brothers? I mean, they sort of made each other in a sense, didn't they?
To an extent. I mean, they had the Bryants had some big country hits before that, primarily for Carl Smith and Jimmy Dickens, both Opry performers
from
1948 on. They met the Everly Brothers in the late 50s, I think 57, and Bye Bye Love was a song that they had tried to sell to a number of people. Chet Atkins was going to produce it for someone but wanted to change a chord that Budlow refused to have changed. And there was one unsuccessful recording of it before, but they gave it to these young, hungry kids who were looking for their spot, and the rest is, we can hear the history.
She sure looks happy, I sure am blue. She was my baby. I think I'm gonna cry. Bye bye love.
feel like I could die. Bye-bye, my love, goodbye. I'm through with romance. I'm through with love.
Bye-bye, love, the first of a string of hit songs by the Everly Brothers, written by Felice and Budlow Bryant. The Bryants were husband and wife, and the subject of Franklin Bruno's article in the Oxford American. You can find his an excerpt from that article on the Soundcheck webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. And Franklin, the Everly Brothers, famous for their music and for being a kind of fractious family group.
Reasonably. I mean, I don't think those tensions were publicly known for a long time. They seemed like, I mean, they were much more clean cut than lots of the other, you know, early rock and rollers. So, but there was stuff going on behind the scenes about who got to take the lead and girls and money and, you know.
So when you're in the same family and you're in the same business and in the same office, you know, these kinds of tensions happen. The Bryants were husband and wife. So how did they kind of find a way of working together over such a long period of time?
Well, again, I mean, there's not a strict separation between who's the lyricist and who's the musician. You can find songs by both that are credited alone. Early on, because of the way the business was, Felice's name wouldn't have really been on the credits because, you know, women weren't in the business. But even then, they were collaborating. But later, a song like Love Hurts is actually, you know, it's credited to Budlow himself. And that's a sign of something later in their career. But
A sign of what?
A sign that he wrote it himself.
Oh, okay. As opposed to them having a tiff and
right,
he went off.
Right. The only big tension that I've come across, you know, and these aren't people that there have been volumes written about every little thing they did. So I don't know what their family, they didn't live in the public eye the same way that, that Dolly Parton and Porter Wagoner did or something like that. But apparently at some point early in their career, Felice was writing some songs with another partner, and that upset Budlow and demanded that she break off that. And so, I mean, it's telling about what their relationship was and what it was about for so long that that's where the tension would come from.
So it was a professional tension.
Creative infidelity rather than the kind that's in most country songs, right?
What about the figure of Chet Atkins lurking on the periphery of this marriage songwriting partnership?
Yeah, well, he was a studio player. He wasn't well known in his own right. I mean, he's the rare country picker, right, who becomes a famous figure in his own right. He was there. He's on those early Everly's records. He was kind of a ad hoc. He and Budlow were kind of ad hoc arrangers, co-producers. And Budlow actually wrote a number of tricky instrumentals. I mean, he was the trained composer. Felice would come up with melodies, but Budlow would notate them. But Budlow wrote some instrumentals, like there's a tune called Chaplain in New Shoes that's just a almost Fahey-esque, John Fahey-ish guitar instrumental that Chet Atkins recorded himself. And he also recorded, as a solo artist, I Can Hear Kentucky Calling Me, another song, another one of their state songs.
We're speaking with Franklin Bruno, the writer and musician whose essay on the Bryants, Felice and Budlow Bryant, is in the Oxford American Music issue. It's called The Honeymooners. I mean, as far as you can tell, was it all one big, long honeymoon for them?
As far as you can tell, I mean, there are only a couple of long interviews with them, and they do tend to sound very, very optimistic and loving. Of course, they're multimillionaires by the time that people are interviewing them in the 80s, so it's easy to think that things have gone well at that
point.
Well, now,
their first break came in 1949, Country Boy by Little Jimmy Dickens, and then in 1953, they score their first number one hit, and it's with this song by Carl Smith called Hey Joe.
Hey Joe, she's got skin as creamy, dreamy, eyes that look so lovey-dovey, lips as red as cherry berry wine. Now listen, Joe, I ain't no hero, but oh, buddy, let me tell you how I feel. She's a
honey, she's a sugar pie. I'm warning you, I'm gonna try to steal her from you. Hey, Joe, though we've been the best of friends, this is where our friendship ends. I gotta have that dolly for my own.
Number one hit from 1953 by Carl Smith called Hey Joe. It was the first number one hit written by Felice and Budlow Bryant, who, as Franklin Bruno was just telling us, would go on to great success, become multimillionaires, leave behind a great legacy of songs. This one, that's 1953. Mm-hmm. That could pass for a much more recent song.
Yeah, in certain ways. I mean, the thing that I notice about it as a more of a student of songwriting than as a student of country music specifically is it's actually the melody lines are pretty long. It has a lot of internal rhymes. It's pretty clever. It's not the chords aren't complicated, but mm-hmm. it's a rather elaborate looping around melody.
Now, you've also mentioned just in passing a song called Love Hurts, mm-hmm. which inadvertently, these people wrote the first power ballad, the first, you know.
That's my claim anyway.
Well, yes. But it seems, I mean, I remember when this song was a big hit for the band Nazareth, mm-hmm. who otherwise had a completely unremarkable, virtually unknown career.
Journeyman hard rockers,
yes.
I think you would say.
Where did this song come? I mean, that was in the mid-70s when Nazareth had a hit with Love Hurts.
75, I think. Yeah.
Where did it? Who did they originally intend? Was this another one for the Everly Brothers?
Yeah, it first appeared. Actually, there are two recordings that came out very, very close together. One on the Everly Brothers' first full album for Warner Brothers, which also contained Kathy's Clown, which was a number one hit that the Bryants didn't write. That was Don Everly's song. That was their big hit of the period. But a couple of great songs, that and Sleepless Nights, known now through Graham Parsons and many others, were just album tracks on this. And at that time, albums were not that important in the market in 1960, especially for a teen-oriented group. So they're kind of buried. But Roy Orbison also recorded Love Hurts. And it was at a point where there were some tensions among, between the Everlys and their manager, Wesley Rose, that led to Rose kind of freezing out the Bryants from giving the Everlys new songs for a couple of years. So that's one reason that some of their very best songs for the Everly Brothers and songs that have, you know, eventually broken through in other forms weren't released as singles. They would probably, if that relationship had been different, there'd probably be half a dozen more huge Everly hits that we would know.
You may recognize the song, although you may not recognize this original 1960 recording from the Everly Brothers.
Love scars, love wounds, and mars any heart not tough nor strong enough to take a lot of pain.
That is how the Everly Brothers recorded the song Love Hurts by Felice and Budlow Bryant back in 1960. 1975, the Scottish band Nazareth has a go and goes all the way to the top with it. Love Hurts, the Nazareth recording, their one and only hit from 1975, the song written by Felice and Budlow Bryant, who are the topic of the essay that Franklin Bruno wrote for the Oxford American. You can see an excerpt from it on the Soundcheck webpage. Franklin's with me in the studio on Soundcheck today. So the Everly Brothers recorded their songs, Nazareth recorded their songs, Simon and Garfunkel, the Mekons, I mean, they went all the way.
Sure,
to
Sleepless Nights, great version of Sleepless Nights.
Did they record their songs?
Yes, occasionally. I don't get the impression that they were mainly frustrated performers. Budlow had toured as a Western swing violinist. That's how he met Felice, originally Genevieve Scaduto, in Wisconsin, where she was from.
Her name was Genevieve?
Yeah.
Where did Felice come from?
Just a family nickname that that they decided that they liked better.
Okay.
And maybe a little more country. I mean, Skidoodo. I don't know how that's going to work. But they recorded a couple of singles, almost novelty-ish things in the 50s. There's a song called I Dreamed About a Wedding. But mostly not. It seemed like they were largely content. They didn't even like to do demos. They liked to invite artists who were looking for songs up to their place, eventually in Gatlinburg, to go through their sheafs of unpublished material. They either published and didn't record or never published a lot of songs that we don't know, really. Mm-hmm. And they preferred to just play people's songs. So they didn't even like going into the studio that much at this point. They did occasionally.
And how appreciated were they for the songwriting gifts that they so obviously had with all these number one hits? Did people in Nashville know who the Bryants were?
Oh, yeah. I think in the community. And even after she retired from – even after Boudlow died and Felice did do some writing after his death – but she often would go to country awards shows and pick up honors and things like that, often accompanied by one of her sons, one of whom now works with BMI. So it's remained in the family, and they're definitely well known in that community, partially because of the association with Atkins, who's extremely respected also.
Right. And as we mentioned before, so many people have recorded versions of their songs. Keith Urban, Patti Loveless, Simon and Garfunkel, and surprisingly, the Mekons, who in 1987 recorded Sleepless Nights. '87 recording of Sleepless Nights by the Mekons, a cover of a song from Felice and Boudlow Bryant, the Country Hall of Fame songwriting team, and the subject of this essay that Franklin Bruno has written for the Oxford American. Their legacy, just really quickly, Franklin, all these great songs, number one hits for the Everly Brothers, Wake Up Little Susie, and All I Have to Do Is Dream, and, you know, on and on.
I can't not say Rocky Top at least once.
Well, we're going to hear a little bit.
I'm sorry.
But there's something else. I mean, yes the Tennessee State song, yes. Rocky Top. But their son, one of their sons, also is like, you know, a part of their legacy because he runs the CEO of BMI.
Yeah, that's right. Del Bryant.
Yeah.
Right.
So the family is still very much kind of central in the music business.
Yes.
But the song Rocky Top is, as Franklin says, the official state song of Tennessee, and it is another Felice and Boudlow Bryant tune. Franklin, it's it's great to finally give these well-known but unknown people a moment in the sun. Thanks for sharing their story with us.
I agree. Look at the writing credits.
This is Soundcheck. Rocky Top, Tennessee. Tomorrow night on the show, we'll hear about one of the latest incarnations of the Nashville sound, that being Nashville, the ABC drama about two rival country music stars. I'll talk with Callie Corey, the show's creator and executive producer, plus an in-studio session from the young New York trombonist and composer Ryan Keberly. His new album, Music is Emotion, features original tunes and songs by Art Farmer, Billy Strayhorn, and indie rocker Sufjan Stevens. See you back here tomorrow at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.